Well, come June, it'll be 17 years that Michelle and I tied the knot, so to speak, stood in front of family and friends and said that we give our lives to each other. And gentlemen, you're probably thinking now, how long has it been for us? And so wives, you can test them after the service how long it has been for you guys. But in 1998, we got married, and our honeymoon, we went down to Southern California. And we had a great time. Took the train into San Diego, enjoyed the sights, great weather. There was only one small problem the whole time of our entire, 10 days, 2 weeks away. And it was a small problem. We ran out of money. Small issue. The reason is because in 98, we didn't have something called overdraft. I didn't have something called a credit card. And we had no other way of getting access to money. So we had 3 days left of our honeymoon, and we had no money. I had $18.59 in the bank, U.S., but only then, at that time, could you only get $20 bills out. So I was, like, stuck. So after 3 days, we're like, what do we do? Because our hotel had a simple buffet of muffins and fruit for the day, and so we would load our pockets up, like, you know, we're like walking out like kind of like this. And they'd be like, what are you doing? You know, obvious, but... it was really, really bad. And so Michelle says at one time, please let me just call my mom and she can wire us some money. And I'm like, no, whatever you do, you're not calling your mom. Because the last thing in the world I want is my mother-in-law to see how I'm treating my new bride. Which kind of sounds ironic because I would rather have my wife starve than actually, you know, provide food for her. I was thinking about this in retrospect, thinking, I'm glad she stuck with me on this. But it was awful. It was bad. So I remember us getting on, we had saved $12. We thought we were so good at the beginning, but we had saved $12 for our cab ride back to the airport. And I remember getting on the airplane, and this is the time when you got free meals. And as soon as we got seated, our seatbelts on, and people were getting on, I said, ma'am, you know, to the flight attendant, can we get our meals now? And she goes, sir, we have to take off first. But Michelle and I were so hungry. We were so hungry, and we were just so thankful for food. I think through all of that, and we have definitely learned a lesson from that when we go on honeymoon, you have to fully count the cost. See, we had counted the cost of 3/4 of our trip, but we had not done that for the last bit. And so we realized, you know what, in life, not just in honeymoon, but we have to count the cost fully before we embark in something. Today I want to talk a little bit about our series more called Surrender, or we could subtitle it Counting the Cost. What does it mean to follow Jesus? We've talked for a number of weeks about some elements about what it means to follow him. But as Chris pointed out last week, we've now taken a shift as we move towards Easter. In Luke chapter 9, where Chris taught from last week, it says in there that Jesus now set his face towards Jerusalem. So we've taken a big shift now, and Jesus is trying to explain to his followers in different ways, what does it mean to count the cost? What does it mean to follow me? So Jesus set his face towards Jerusalem. In other words, with intention, he set his face towards the city that he would know that he would be crucified in. And with that, seems like the stakes went higher. And Jesus is trying to tell his followers, we're not just in this just for the easy going. So I want to talk to you. I don't know what KU does downstairs, but I want to read from the scriptures this morning. And I want to read from Luke 14, verses 25 to 35. Now, as I do this, I want to just say time out. Let's take a step for a second, because if we're all honest, as we take a look at our scriptures and we read our Bibles, if we're honest, we actually kind of treat them like a bit of a buffet, do we not? I know I'm guilty of this a lot of times. In other words, we like to pick and choose what sounds good and attractive to us. So something like, the Lord is my shepherd. Oh, I love it. Sounds so good. I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord, plans to prosper you. I'll take a double helping of that, thank you very much. Maybe nothing can separate us from the love of Christ. Beautiful. So good. But then we come across something like in John 15 where it says, in this world there will be trouble. Yeah, no thank you. I'm just going to pass that and go back to these other ones that I like. And some of them we don't actually just ignore. We actually have a cringe factor. And they're very hard. And today, I believe, is one of those ones that has a bit of a cringe factor for us. It's not easy teaching, but Jesus is trying to do this intentionally because he's trying to cut out those who are just casually following him versus those who are fully on board with their heart and their life towards Jesus. So Jesus is not making a mistake or an accident by stumbling upon these words. He's like, no, it's not what I meant. He fully intended everything he says here. I want to read this for you now. And this is the truth that comes out of all of this, in counting the cost. The one truth that I want to hope all of us get understand a little bit more today is that following Jesus will cost us everything. Ugh. Squirming already a little bit. Following Jesus will cost us everything. So let's go to Luke 14, and I want to start in verses 25 and 26. Verse 25, it says, large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and turning to them, he said. So I want to stop there for a minute. Large crowds were traveling with Jesus. When Chris taught last week, he was just with his disciples, his 12, his close-knit followers of the way. In this passage, it says large crowds. In other words, multitudes. We don't know how many exactly, but there was a lot of people following Jesus. And why not? Previously in Luke, we had seen Jesus do a number of things that were pretty cool in their eyes and amazing. Jesus was healing people. Jesus was calming storms and affecting and controlling nature. Isn't this someone that you would want to kind of be around? Don't we do this? We see someone who's kind of raising in popularity or is well known, maybe a celebrity status, and we want to be popular by association. It was about a month ago, Michelle and I were at Starbucks, and I look over, and especially being a Calgary boy, I knew this right away. I'm like, that's him. I can't believe that's him. I'm like, Michelle, that's Brett the Hitman Hart standing in line for coffee. She's like, cool. And I'm like, no, this is like really cool. Like this is, he wasn't wearing pink, but he was with his outfit that he normally did in wrestling, but he was still there looking a bit older, but still looking like Brett the Hitman Hart. And so I went up to him and I'm like, should I? Michelle's like, yeah, of course. So I had my phone out ready for a selfie. And I was like, Brett? He goes, yeah. I said, nice to see you. My name's Jeff. Big fan. I'm from Calgary. And he didn't even really seem to care. I was like, and I was just ready to say like, hey, you know, can I get a picture with you? But I just saw his tone and the way he looked at me. He wasn't rude, but he was like, I don't want a selfie kind of mood. And being a professional wrestler, I just kind of let that go. So I wish I could show you a picture so that I had proof that I knew, you know, I could say I know Brett the Hitman Hart. I saw him and you just have to trust me. But man, it was cool and I felt so good, but I wish I could take a picture so I could show my friends because all of us want popularity by association. And that's what this crowd did with Jesus. But Jesus then turns to them and listen to what he says. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Does that kind of feel like a punch in the gut? All these people are following Jesus, and suddenly Jesus, it's almost like he turns on them. Did Jesus just say what I think he said? This feels like a shock. Yeah, he said what he just said. Yeah, I heard it too. Why would Jesus say such a thing? Why would Jesus say such a thing? That we must hate our father and mother and our family and even our own life. Do we take this literally? In all honesty, do we take this literally? Does this mean that following Jesus equals hating my family? Because there seems to be a bit of a logic problem here, because Jesus, if he's saying truly, you must hate your family, Jesus also tells us that we must love our enemies. So seriously, Jesus, I don't get it. What are you saying here? See, the Greek word here for hate, mizio, it means exactly what it says. Hate, to detest something with our entire being. So it's not like the Greek people who translated this got this wrong. That's exactly the word there, with every fiber of our being. To help us understand a little bit of this in context, to understand these words, hate our family, I think there's two things we have to understand here, and it's crucial. Number one, is the word hate here, it's a comparative term, not a directive. And it's very important to understand. In other words, Jesus is saying, if you put the two up side by side, following me or loving or following your family and abiding by their wishes, I have to win If you want to be a true disciple of me and a follower of me, I have to win in that battle. So it's a comparative term. In another translation, the New Living Translation, it says this in the same verse. It says, if you want to be my disciple, you must hate everyone else by comparison, even including your family. And the second thing here is that Jesus is using hyperbole to get his point across. Jesus does this quite a bit in his teaching. For instance, when this rich young ruler approaches him once and says, Jesus, what must I do to be saved? Jesus says, you must get rid of all of your possessions. Sell them all. Get rid of them all. And come and follow me. And it tells us that this young ruler went away sad because he had so much. And then Jesus turns to the people and says, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. He doesn't actually mean literally that. He's saying something very large that the Jewish people and others would have known in that time, which was a camel, large animal, versus the smallest thing they would have known, probably, and that is the eye of a needle. He's using it to hyperbole for an illustration. So Jesus is using this word here, too, as an illustration to get his point across. But even then, with all of this understood, we still cringe. Why? Because who does Jesus tell us that we need to hate by comparison? Our own father and mother? Our beloved spouses? Our deeply loved children? Our brothers and sisters? And yes, even our own life. Now, we have to understand that this time in Jesus' time was not our time. So in Jesus' time, it wasn't a matter of if you followed him, you know, if you get persecuted in some way. It was a matter of when and how. That was just the reality for Jesus' followers in Jesus' time. You were going to be persecuted. It's just a matter of when and how. Following Jesus cost them everything. So yes, Jesus says, you know, in earlier passages, you may get ridiculed at work. You may lose your job or even your friends. But you have to lose all of this to commit to following me or to be my disciple. But that cost factor suddenly skyrockets in these verses. Why? Because in Jewish culture, there was one thing that defined you more than anything else. It wasn't your job that defined you. It wasn't the friends that you hung out with that defined you. It was your family. The family was the central unit by which you were known. It was how you were identified and how you were associated. And that's why genealogies in the Bible mean so much. See, in the Old Testament, the nation of Israel, when they were one nation and then divided up and divided the land, it wasn't just like, I'm going to divide it by the 12 best leaders of the land. The Bible tells us in the Old Testament that the father of Israel, Jacob, Jesus says he's the father of the nation. It was his 12 sons that he divided up the nation with. So the nation of Israel was divided by family tribes, not just by your qualifications. And the leaders of these tribes were the sons of Jacob. And so in Israel, if you were a Jewish person, you were known by your association to your family. So you were like, you know, I'm not just Joe, but I'm Joe, son of Gad. Or I'm Bill. I don't know if these were biblical names or not, but I'm Bill, son of Asher. It's like you had an association with that. You were, because they knew what tribe you were from and you were proud of it. And that's why genealogies are so important in the Bible. We often skim over them and kind of yada, yada, okay, yeah, get to this stuff. But that's why they were stated in there. It's because they wanted to know, you to know that everybody has a history, has an ancestry, has a lineage, and therefore has an identity. See, for us, we can be guilty of this, of not knowing our family tree very well. My 10-year-old daughter, Reese, did a project at school recently, and she asked me my great-grandparents' names and where they were born. And I said, go ask your mother. No, I didn't know. I was embarrassed because I was like, and I'm thinking, this is three generations before me, and I don't even know. And so I was a bit embarrassed, and I called my mom. I'm like, Mom, can you help me out here? And so she did. But it got me to thinking, three generations from now, am I ever going to be known to my family? But for the Jewish people, they had no issue of this. It wasn't like they had to sit down and memorize this every day. It was just something they knew in their heart. Family was everything. So Jesus is saying here, what would happen if you had to lose your family members? The people that you love most in the entire world and by which you are known by in order to follow me, would you still do it? Would you be willing to forsake a good job in your dad's business or even become homeless and live in poverty if that's what it took to follow me? See, these are tough words from Jesus that we dare not take lightly, and that's exactly his intention, for people to stop and count the cost before they just jumped in. And so the question I think here is not so much, will you hate your family as a directive, but rather, will you be okay with your family hating you if you decide to follow me? And you better count that cost before you jump in, because it's going to get hard and there is going to be persecution. In verse 27, he goes on to state this, "And if anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple." Things aren't getting easier. Jesus, give us a break here a little bit. But Jesus, again, is intentionally making it hard for people, and he wants them to understand. Unless you are willing to carry your cross. See, that was an image right away the Jewish people knew. Because all lined up the major streets in the major cities were crosses. And people hanging on them. And they weren't Roman people. Because the Romans were the ones that crucified, but because it was such a brutal way to die, it was against the Roman law for them to crucify their own people. So they would crucify criminals, most often Jewish people, for different things. But in order for them to be crucified, they would force them to carry their cross over to where they would be crucified. And they knew that. So when you saw a person on the road struggling with a cross, you knew where that person was ending up. And so when Jesus says, you must be willing to carry your cross, he's not talking in a figurative sense here. He's being very literal. And right away, the Jews would have known exactly what he was talking about. Jesus has no hidden agenda because he doesn't want people's decisions first and then after to explain what they signed up for. We are lulled into that in so many things in our culture today. Just sign here. And then, by the way, here's what you signed up for. Jesus doesn't do that. And in fact, he goes out of his way to make sure there's no three-point font hidden on the back of anything I want you to sign up for. If your heart is willing to engage and follow me, you have to be willing to even let your family persecute you, be divided from your family, and even to go to the point of being crucified, to lose your life for the sake of following me. So now all of you people by popularity, by association, how is this starting to feel? Do you think they started to count the cost? Now, if the Jewish people hearing this were in shock by this point, Jesus goes on to use two images to illustrate his point, both ones that the Jewish people would have understood instantly, a tower or a temple and a battle. Let's move on to Luke 14, verse 28. So Jesus, after saying all of this, he says, "So, suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Will he not first sit down and estimate the cost to see if he has enough money to complete it? For if he lays the foundation and is not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule him, saying, 'This fellow began to build and was not able to finish.' Or suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Will he not first sit down and consider whether he is able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? If he is not able, he will send a delegation while the other is still a long way off and will ask for terms of peace. In the same way, any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple." Two well-known images for these Jewish people that were listening. There's a cathedral in Barcelona, Spain, called the Sagrada Familia. Here's a picture of it here. Beautiful. In Barcelona, they want this to be the center of Barcelona spiritually. They want everyone to be looking at this and go, "Wow, ah, this is amazing." But I'll be honest though, this is actually not what it looks like right now. This is what they hope it looks like when it's done. This has been photoshopped with all the cranes and everything taken out of it, so they can show people what it actually looks like. See, the reality of this, like I said, it's been photoshopped. The first brick that was laid for this was actually in 1882. And understandably, a number of complications have prevented it from being completed. So it first started construction in 1882, and it's not done yet. This is what it looks like today. There's cranes all over the place. The exterior still needs a lot of work, and let's not even talk about the interior. A number of things have stopped it, but it's because the builders never counted the cost properly. In fact, they have no idea how much this has cost, but the builders are back on track, and they're saying, hopefully, if all goes well, that it will be finished in 2026, 144 years after construction began. Don't you think there's a few people around kind of a little bit cynical, a little bit laughing, a little bit mocking of these builders? And that's exactly what Jesus is saying. If you don't count the cost first, you're going to run out of money and people are going to make fun of you. So first count the cost. See, we can do the same in building our own towers. We build our towers in our lives that we run ahead with without fully thinking things through. We can build our images based on our religious duties, our self-image, possessions, our pride, our accomplishments, and our reputation, so that people look at us and admire us. And then we realize maybe while the exterior is done and looks wonderful, we've neglected to count the cost because the interior is in shambles. We may look good, but our heart could be very cold towards God. We've neglected to count the cost of the entire building. The other picture is with a battle. Jesus says that a good king doesn't just blindly challenge other armies because he's cocky, but he sits down with his advisors and he looks at numbers. And he realizes, you know what? If we are vastly outnumbered, we are stupid to forge ahead. And so if we realize that they've got a lot more people, isn't it wise if we actually meet a delegation in the middle and say, you know what? You know, however you want to craft this, but we're willing to negotiate peace here, knowing that if we don't, not really wanting to tell the other side, but if we don't, not only are our men going to be killed, but we are going to lose our lives too. To just rush out into battle is stupid. We must count the cost before we engage in something so life-altering. The Jewish people would have known this as well, because there was so much political and military upheaval. Knowing the Romans ruled the day, but they wanted to bring them down. You see, for us, we often wage battles in our own life too, and we think we win. We think that God owes us something because we have fought battles for acts of justice, acts of righteousness, and that we think that we've gained the upper hand. I remember years ago in youth ministry when I was talking to a bunch of students about sin and this whole idea that we have all sinned and fallen short of God's glory. This high school student came up to me and she was disgusted. She said, "How dare you talk to me about sin?" She goes, "My family, my dad's a dentist, we're well off." She goes, "We have given more in generosity than I'm sure at least 90% of your church has. And you call it sinful?" You see, she had waged this war and thought that she had earned God's favor by winning the battle of being righteous and generous. In all of this, remember, Jesus isn't just looking for a rash prayer to be repeated. He wants a heart and life that desires to follow him. And he tells us that following him will cost us everything. And are we willing to follow him? He then finishes it off with two verses. In this whole discourse, he says this: "Salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is neither fit for the soil nor for the manure pile." Ooh. "It is thrown out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear." Essentially, he's telling the people that yes, persecution will be part of your journey, but that through all of this, that your lives lived out before all of the rest of the people, the rest of the nations, the Romans and everyone, will actually point people to me, Yahweh, the God who saves and provides and cares and loves. And that's actually the role of the Jewish people in the first place. is to point people to God. Their lives were not for their own gain, and Jesus is telling them that once again. But it's rather to bring glory to their Heavenly Father, to all nations, just as it was at their inception. Just as it is for us today as Jesus followers, to point people to this loving God and who are willing to count the cost. See, I guess in the application portion of this, if we want to go there, I find this very hard. And I hope that maybe you kind of see it hard as well. Because if we're honest, to put it into proper context, we face such little persecution in our Western world compared to the persecution that they faced in Jesus' time. I'm not saying we don't at all, but I'm saying we face little comparatively. Do we get made fun of for making our beliefs known at the office through an issue like abortion? Do we get teased at school for saying that we believe in creation over evolution? Maybe get mocked among friends because we give money voluntarily to church instead of putting that money into a vacation fund or an existing RSP? In all honesty, those are issues of persecution, and we've seen others. And I'm not saying those are nothing, not at all. When we take a stand for Jesus, those things will happen. But it feels like a little bit of mockery and teasing compared to being disassociated and kicked out from our families and possibly losing our lives seems to pale in comparison. Now, I understand that if we take those words from Jesus literally, that there are some here who have experienced being kicked out from their families and persecution from their friends or their families because of walking with Jesus. And if that's you this morning, Jesus says, keep on. Keep on, because the road is worth it. And it doesn't mean we disrespect our parents and stop caring about them and trying to make inroads into their lives. But following Jesus is the greatest thing that we can possibly do. But it is not easy. And there are other places in the world where it is magnified, this difficulty. On our very own MB Mennonite Brethren Mission website, if you go to mbmission.org, you will see a little link and it says stories. And I would say click on that because you will see a lot of stories of people in other parts of the world who are facing this family persecution. I want to just highlight one quickly. It's about a girl named Julia, and her name has been changed on the website. Here's her story very quickly. She was riding the bus one day when she overheard a Westerner on the seat behind her talking to a man about God. Turning around, she asked him, "Are you a Christian?" She said this was the beginning of Julia's relationship with a team of missionaries. During her last year of school, however, Julia came under great attack from the enemy. She told the missionaries, "I cannot be a Christian anymore. I know that Christianity is true, but I cannot accept the cost." Julia felt like she was being a traitor to her own people. You see, Buddhists, which she was a part of and her family was, are simply who they are, and they cannot separate themselves from this fact. When she would try to share her faith with her friends, she was left with heaviness in her heart and the sentiment that she was being disowned by her people for being a follower of Jesus. She said being a Christian felt to her like too much of a burden. She doesn't believe that her parents will ever come to know Christ, and she can't bear the thought of being separated from them for eternity. At present, at this point in time, Julia claims that she doesn't feel anything. She has no emotion, and she's numb. She's not a Buddhist because she can't go back to it, but she's not walking in obedience to Christ either. Julia's struggle illustrates the clash of kingdoms. When the gospel of the kingdom comes against the kingdom of darkness, it stirs up tremendous opposition. The story ends by saying, please pray for Julia for strength and resolve in her walk with Jesus. I shared that story because not every story has a happy ending. There are people like Julia all over the world who are facing persecution from their families, being kicked out, maybe abused or killed because of their following of Jesus. So for us as believers out west, if we've never experienced any of that, do we just say, hey, I'm thinking about you and I'm just, you know, whatever. I think we have a responsibility here, and I just want to give three very quick ones as far as tangible responses that we can have. Number one is gratitude. When was the last time we stopped the rush of our days and the things that we have to get done and stop and realize what we have? We have a freedom in our part of the world that others do not. And we've done nothing to deserve it. Just by being born here in Canada, we have these freedoms that others do not. I don't think it's something that we need to feel guilty about, but I do believe that we need to stop, take stock, and say, God, thank you for the place in which we live. And if you have parents who love Jesus this morning, God, say, God, thank you for that as well. The second emotion that I think we need a response of is sorrow. Do we hear stories like Julia and just kind of let that pass off? Or does our heart grieve? I think we need to pray for those in persecution around the world much more than we do. And a simple yet very powerful response to that is either on your own, as a family, life group, whatever. Go to the mbmission.org website, click on the stories, and begin to pray through some of these ones that are on there because they are listed by name. And they're real people. We can pray for them. And number three is boldness. In other words, the question is, if we have freedom here, what are we doing with our freedom? Are we sitting on our hands? Or are we actually going out in our freedom to share Jesus with people? Knowing that, to be honest, we actually get very little persecution in doing so. Do we tell people the freedom and the joy that comes by following Jesus? That there is nothing greater in this world? Or do we just go about our own way? Lastly, and I close with this, is that we must remember that all of this seems heavy. Yes, it absolutely does. But we are not alone, nor are we ever alone. If we profess to follow Jesus today and live our lives in such a way, then we know that we have one who even conquered death living inside us. And I hope that at the end of this, this not only feels like a heavy message, but one that we can leave with hope with, because we have the one who is greater. In 1 John 4:4, it says, "You, dear children, are from God and have overcome, because the one who is in you is greater than the one who is in the world." Amen? The one who is in you is greater than the one who is in the world. We are on the winning side. We are on the winning side, folks. And I love that. So when we actually think about this and go, I'm counting the cost, but I'm hearing this and it doesn't really sound enticing. No. That's because Jesus lays it on the line and says, there is trouble, but take heart because I have overcome the world. I have defeated even death itself. First Peter 5:10, and I close with this. "And the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, after you have suffered a little while, will himself make you strong, firm, and steadfast. To him be the power forever and ever." Amen.